Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, July 18th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I'm so excited because this week I finally sat down with Bob Novella of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. He is the last rogue that I actually had on the show. So I'm really excited to share that with you guys. But before we jump into it, I just want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Now remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And the way that I'm able to make it free for every single person is through the generous support of listeners like you. Man, I sound like public television. So this week, I want to thank those of you who visited my Patreon page at patreon.com/talknerdy or who went there by visiting my website, carasantamaria.com. Specifically, I want to give a shout out to Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover, who are giving at the highest level this week. And also, I want to give a shout out to Rod Adams, Charles Payet, Jafe, The Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last, but as usual, not least, Jeffrey Sewell. I also want to thank those of you who give as you can, because again, it really helps keep the podcast going. All right, enough of that. Without any further ado, here he is, your skeptical rogue from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Bob Novella. Okay. Bob, thank you so much for joining me to talk nerdy today.
Oh my God, my pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. We've been trying to do it for many months, and we finally were able.
Yeah, months now.
Yeah, it's like, oh, either you were busy or I was busy or whatever, so I'm glad we were able to connect. I knew we would, just a matter of time.
Me too. So you are the last of the rogues to come on Talk Nerdy. I think that I talked nerdy with Steve before, or maybe it was Jay, before I ever joined SGU, and then everybody else came later. Yeah, I think it was Jay first.
Yeah, Jay told me, he's like, Bob, you're lucky, you're being interviewed by Kara, and when I did it, I didn't even know her, so, and he said it was a wonderful interview. It was like, at least now you kind of know her, and it's more like friends talking instead of kind of two strangers when you talked with him, so.
Yeah, but it's always funny to me when I do have people on the show how much better I know them after the hour than I ever did before, because you end up asking questions that you just like don't really ask in polite conversation, or just like shooting the shit.
I know.
You're like, wow, yeah. Like, when's the last time we talked?
Well, sure.
For an
hour, we've done a million episodes together. Oh, I think maybe almost never. And so, I absolutely understand, because we've done a lot together, many, many scores of episodes, live shows, but never really just sat down and shot the shit like we're going to do right now. So, yeah, I understand. You will definitely know me, depending on your questions, of course. I would know me a little bit better after the next hour, sure.
I'm definitely interested in, like, I think what we'll get to definitely is how you came into skepticism, and also a little bit about your relationship with your bros and kind of your specific interest, because I feel like Bob Novella on SGU has a very specific flavor that I think speaks to a lot of people. So we'll definitely jump into that. But one thing that I like just realized I don't know about you after, like we said, a whole year of being on SGU together at this point. I don't know what you
do. What I do,
for
my job.
Yes.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. My job, I'm a software configuration manager, so I work in IT. So I work with a lot of developers, programmers. I work with QA testers. I work with project managers. So I'm kind of in that software development lifecycle loop. I do a lot of code deployment to the various testing environments and production environments. So some code deployment. I also do a lot of troubleshooting. So if there's a problem with some of the important servers, they give me a call any hour of the day. Last night, I got a call at like 11 o'clock. Like, oh well, here we go. But it's not too bad. I don't get too many 3 a.m. calls. So I sort of do a lot of troubleshooting, fixing, you know, trying to fix problems because there's, you know, when you've got hundreds of servers that you're kind of responsible for, there's always going to be some inevitable problems. And a lot of these production servers, I mean, if they're not working, we don't, you know, the company doesn't make money, so it's quite urgent. I also started delving back into programming in the past 6 months. Doing PowerShell programming, basically to automate a lot of my administrative tasks. And I am kind of still shocked at how rewarding I'm finding programming. I'm not a good programmer. I'm not a big programmer. I haven't done it in years. I studied it a little bit in grad school, and it was like Pascal. And if you know programming, Pascal is like an old language that nobody in their right mind would program in. But once you learn programming, you get the idea of functions and variables and some of the basic stuff. So I asked my boss. I said, I'd like to learn this, especially after my friend at work, who I really respect, said, Bob, you need to learn PowerShell programming because that is an amazing skill set for somebody in your field. And I took that to heart. And after 4 months of kind of thinking about it and not doing anything, I said, all right, I got to get off my butt and do this. And I'm just amazed at how much I love it. These little scripts that I create, they're like my babies. I love them so much. I even get this. It's Saturday afternoon or Sunday night. There's nothing good on TV. I don't really have anything to read right now. I log into work and work on my scripts. That is unheard of. Because if I don't need to log into work, I do not log into work. But I log into work just to work on these guys, and it's just so amazingly rewarding. I just can't get enough of it. So that's my job. That's my day job.
And what kind of software? Is it like financial software? Is it educational software? Like what kind of work is it?
It's, well, the software, you know, I don't test it. I don't use it. I could tell you basically what it is, but it's kind of software that and programs that I never use. So I don't have a detailed knowledge of what these people do with it. And that's fine with me. That's fine with me because I don't need to clog my brain with stuff like that. But it's software that people use in the company to do their jobs. It's software that members throughout the world will use that affiliate with our company. So it's a lot of it's web loyalty. There's also, and web loyalty is basically, you know, we will join partnerships with eBay or PayPal, and we, you know, this is a tiny unit of the company. The big company does a lot of other stuff, but they, you know, so we do what we can to keep these members of PayPal or eBay or whatever, to keep them happy and gotcha. Engaged and stuff. But it's also insurance and lots of other stuff that I really just don't really care too much about because I don't need to know about it, and that's fine. I mean, if I was a tester, then sure, I would need to know. But it's like whatever. It's kind of like in my heads down, you know, head down in my little world of deploying and troubleshooting. I don't even really need to know how this stuff works, and that's fine with me.
But the coding that you're actually doing, the programming that you've started doing recently,
yes,
is to help you manage your side of the work that you do. It's to help automate some of the work that you do.
Right. So I do administrative stuff like create websites, and then websites have many, many components to them, like host names and binders and bindings and IP addresses and things. I do a lot of working with IIS, Internet Information Service, so dealing with the websites themselves. And I have to do lots of different things with these websites, and there's lots of steps and lots of things to do to create them and maintain them. So if I'm creating websites or adding bindings, I create these PowerShell scripts to do it for me. So instead of manually creating these websites on 6 different servers, I can script it, and instead of a half hour or 40 minutes, I can do the task at the press of a button, and it takes minutes. So basically, I'm doing my job more quickly, more efficiently, and of course, my bosses love it because it's much less error prone, and they're always amazed. They say, "Okay, Bob, you know, I'm on a conference call with 25 people doing this big, complicated production code deploy and update, and everybody's got tasks, and it's laid out step by step, and it's like, okay, Bob, we're ready for your task," and I'm like, "Okay, I'm starting now," and then within 20 seconds, okay, I'm done. And they're like, wow, you're done already. That's fantastic. And I just love it. I just love it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's just so rewarding.
So you and Jay both kind of work in a technical space like that. It's interesting to me that when we do stories on SGU, Jay seems to be really obsessed with computational stories. You almost never bring computational stories to the show, you almost always focus on either theoretical physics or cosmology. Those are like your big interest areas, aren't they?
Oh my God, they're huge. That I'm just so addicted to those two specific areas. It's funny because when we first started doing the podcast back in 2005, it was The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. We're going to talk about skepticism and critical thinking. So I just assumed, all right, we're all going to scour the internet for skepticism related topics. And I did that. I did that for a while, and very quickly that, there's not a lot of, there's not a lot of like skeptical news that's like, stuff that people are talking about that just came out necessarily.
Yeah.
It's not like science.
Or it
science.
Becomes variations on a theme where it's like, another person faith healed their kid and they died. Like it becomes kind of sad after a while.
Right. And then
it's
after
another person was taken advantage of.
And after doing that for just a little while, I was like, there's not a lot to choose from. And it's after a while, you pretty much cover all the big stuff. It's like, I don't want to cover this again. And then I don't know when I had the epiphany, but it hit me that, wait, I mean, this science news that comes out is ubiquitous. There's so much of it. And I decided that my real niche niche, however you pronounce that word. What's your take on
niche.
That word? Is it niche or niche?
I say niche.
Yeah, I kind of
I'm
like,
very Texas.
I like niche as well. But I figured out that my niche really is the hard science that I love. And the show has transformed over the years from mostly skepticism and critical thinking to a closer ratio of science news reporting, and that's great for me. But I try, to stick. If you notice, I just really do science. I don't pick skeptical topics really. I mean, I could apply the skepticism for say a physics story if I think that some of these people are believing some wacky stuff, especially quantum woo and stuff like that. I could put the angle in that way. But I just love communicating science, and of course the physics and astronomy and cosmology. Those are that's my wheelhouse. I just love that shit. I can't get enough of it, and I've kind of settled into that role for many, many years now, and I'm totally fine with that. I just absolutely love it.
Yeah, I think that probably, I've only been on the show with you guys for about a year, but that's closer to my approach too. I think I have a little less expertise in the skeptical kind of movement, but my expertise actually is in science. So for me, I'll find these science stories that are really interesting. I also love talking about science stories that I like probably have no business talking about. I'll find a story where I'm like, that's fascinating. I want to learn everything I can and then present it. And so, invariably I'll get something wrong or something. I won't have enough background like jet fuel versus avgas to really know the difference. But it's so fun for me to be able to learn about something new. But I'll tell you what, when you present your stories on SGU, there's so much passion in your voice because I know that, what we're learning in the quantum realm is just so fascinating to you. And B, I think you really do a great job of breaking it down. I still have the problem like I often have when I'm learning about quantum mechanics where like as somebody's talking to me about it, I'm like, I totally get it. This makes perfect sense. But I'm not sure I could turn around and then repeat it, and explain it to somebody else quite yet.
Yeah, that is an amazing topic, which I actually don't cover as much as I probably should. I mean, I'll cover physics for sure, but the quantum stuff is dicey. I mean, that takes a lot of prep, and a lot of people just kind of zone out when you talk about that. So I don't cover it too much, but it's such a fascinating topic for me. Quantum mechanics, there's so many parts of it that are so counterintuitive, which I think is a hallmark of quantum mechanics in terms of things like superposition and entanglement. That to me, that people look for magic and they believe in goofy supernatural magic, but that's magic. That is the magic in the universe at its smallest scales. The universe is fucking crazy. It's insane. Yeah. And that, to me, that's wonderful. It's such an incredible thing. And it's so important. It's not an esoteric thing like supernovas. What does supernovas have to do with my day-to-day life? Well, quantum mechanics has quite a bit to do with your day-to-day life because your computers won't work without quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
I read a figure where if you calculated the percentage of our GDP that comes from quantum mechanics, you know, technology based in quantum mechanics, it's a crazy number. I don't know what it was, 60%, 70%, whatever it is, it was not insignificant. And it's just such an amazing thing. And of course, because it's so amazing and counterintuitive, you know, paranormal people love latching onto it. And quantum woo is a term that we throw around a lot. It's, you know, it's like when electricity or even radioactivity was brand new to people, that if you looked at the products and technology that were coming out, there was a whole plethora of things based on electricity, especially, that sounded like, yeah, maybe they could really do this stuff. But if you look at it today, it's like, oh man, that's crazy. How could they think that would actually work? But it was a brand new thing back then. So that's kind of like what they're doing with quantum mechanics. And I think there's still so much to see in the future. There's a lot of talk now about quantum computers, and that is just, who knows what we're going to be able to do with that. You know, we're at it, you know, the infancy of that, those technologies now, and who knows where it could go.
It's so funny that we live in a society now, we live in a culture where we are so capable as a species of simultaneously utilizing science and technology as the backbone of everything we are and everything we do, and yet still fundamentally being able to straight up like deny its utility. Like that there's so many people out there who are either anti-science or just don't think about science in a way, don't trust scientists, don't understand scientific thought and scientific endeavors, yet use the products of science every day. It's like this grand irony that so many people live.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that we see in skepticism, that, you know, a lot of people that believe in, that are credulous and believe in the woo, they long for the seal of approval of science, because they know in their heart that science there has accomplished a lot, and they know it carries a lot of weight with people. And if they could say, my scientific studies prove my version of woo, they want that. A lot of them want that. And but also, if science goes against their sacred cows, they are very quick to dismiss it, because this is their worldview, and they can't have their worldview being sullied by science or anything else. So there is kind of a dichotomy there. They long for its approval, but they're willing to dismiss it if it doesn't agree with their worldview.
Yeah. So you've been in the skeptical movement for a long time, and I think in a bit I want to kind of break down how you kind of entered into it. But before I do that, I would love to know from you, you know, like you said, early on in the early days of SGU, most of your stories and most of your focuses were in skepticism and in kind of debunking woo. What do you think is your favorite kind of category of woo? Where do you really like reading and being like, oh God, this is crazy, I want to read everything about this?
Wow, this shouldn't be a hard question.
Right? It's funny. Right? Like I could probably peg Evan, for example, because I know Evan loves like exorcisms.
Right, right.
Like it's so obvious because he loves to talk about it. Like it's kind of, I feel like everybody, and of course, Steve loves like the bullshit medical woo
stuff.
Because that's, yeah, I mean, because that's where his expertise lies. And
I mean, it might be quantum woo because it's kind of at the junction between my love of science and skepticism. I mean, that's a big one. But I mean, I don't talk about it too much anymore. I mean, I've covered it. I've written about it a little bit years ago when we were at the NES, the New England Skeptical Society, and we had a newsletter that would come out quarterly. I wrote about it a lot. But I mean, quantum woo kind of things, things that are kind of related to science, like maybe like the fake moon landing type of stuff that's interesting. Mm. That's interesting to me. Mechanisms of self-deception was kind of an early favorite for me in terms of areas that I talked about and was proficient in and really enjoyed. To me, it's fascinating when I learned just how our brains don't record and reflect reality. They construct reality. And in terms of perception, sight, even hearing, and memory. So all these things, our brain, you know, our brain is a very cool little thing inside of our heads, but it's so unreliable. And people just don't realize that. They do not understand that their brain is now not recording reality. It's just kind of creating it as it goes along to make a cohesive narrative for us that kind of makes sense. sense. And so the ways that we can deceive ourselves is such an important part of skepticism, I think. And people people say to you, why would this person be lying about whatever, seeing a ghost or whatever? And we say they're not lying. They truly believe this, but they've been led astray, you know, by their brain, by their expectations, by their beliefs, and to come to a false conclusion. And that's such an important part of skepticism, to understand where your perception can fail and cause you to have or to engage in pathological thinking. So that's fascinating for me.
I think that was probably a fundamental part of because my undergrad was in psychology, and learning about that kind of cog psych stuff and learning about why we have to understand that we are fallible in our thinking and where all of those sort of like cognitive biases come in. That was so important for me to move on to neuroscience and to be a good professor and to really, I think, start to establish myself as a scientific and skeptical thinker, because I feel like without that it's foundational to everything in skepticism. You're absolutely right. You know what? Speaking of, there's a great documentary on Netflix right now. I just watched it the other night when I couldn't sleep, called Dishonesty, The Truth About Lying.
Ooh, okay.
Have you seen it? Yeah,
no,
you should check it out.
Anybody I'm all over Netflix, so yeah. Tell me about it.
Yes. So it's a new doc, and it follows a researcher named Dan Ariely, who is basically a psychologist, a cognitive scientist, whose whole mission in his lab is to study self-deception. And he sort of, the whole documentary is just these little vignettes of the different ways that we deceive ourselves, and then backing it up with like really cool laboratory experiments that they do. Sort of their paradigm in the doc is this, they build a lot on this one type of test where university students will sit down and they'll take a test, and the researchers tell them for every question you answer or for every question you finish, you get $1. And then at the very end, they say, you know, I finished 7 of them. They give them $7 and then they shred the test. But of course, they've rigged the shredder so that it only shreds the sides of the test and they can actually still read it after the end. And so then they vary on that theme with all sorts of crazy things. Like,
well,
what
that's
happens
great.
If some kid says he finishes within 30 seconds? Yeah. Are other people going to lie and say that they finished early? It's like all this stuff about social cues with lying, lying to yourself. When is it more appropriate to lie to yourself? When do you start to kind of struggle with the moral, you know, question of whether or not you can lie? Like, one really interesting thing that they showed is that when swearing on the Bible before you take the test, even self-declared atheists are less likely to lie. And it's because it has nothing to do, as he's repeating, with the Bible. It has to do with a reminder of your own intrinsic morality. Like, the minute that you're reminded of your own moral code, you are less likely to lie, which is amazing.
Well, that's a good tip. You know, if you're trying to get the truth out of somebody, you know, maybe, you know, try to remind them in whatever way you want that of their own moral code, and that would be a good way to at least increase the odds of them not lying. One other point I wanted to make about self-deception is that that is what makes science so amazing and so productive, is that it's inherent in the act of science is a systematic way of safeguarding against self-deception. That's why it's so powerful, because that's how it's designed. You know, you have to, you know, you come up with a, you know, an experiment, a hypothesis, and a theory, and it's the job of other people to not only to rip it apart, but also to replicate it. And that's why, you know, it can remove or minimize the chance of people either deceiving themselves or, you know, purposely trying to deceive others with it. So, you know, any lie in science eventually will come out, you know.
It's true.
It might take time, but it will happen.
Yeah, operative word there being eventually, because I think that's one thing that I'm really proud to be part of SGU, one thing that I'm proud that we do, which is actually turn our glasses inward, turn our microscope on ourselves, and really start to, you know, carefully focus on places within the scientific community where there might be either fraud or mistakes or retractions or things that don't seem to hold as much water as we hoped. Because, of course, Self-deception is so strong that even within the sciences, we will see these mistakes happen, and it's up to other scientists within the community, like you said, through replication or through systematic review or through peer review to yep. actually make sure that those mistakes that inevitably happen aren't perpetuated.
Oh, yeah. I just find it so distasteful when, you know, people will make mistakes and they'll, you know, they'll do things that they will not know that they're doing. But when you find, purposeful fraud in science, mm-hmm. to me, that's just so repugnant because, you know, eventually you're going to be found out. So, you know, hey, why, you know, it's such short term thinking to think that this is going to end well. I mean, it can't end well because things we've seen with stem cell research and even cold fusion, you know, cold fusion was probably more not intentional, but some of the stuff we've seen in other countries or even, I guess, the United States where it was intentional fraud, it's just really, that is disgusting. You should just lose your science card. You're done.
I agree. And it reminds me a lot of some of the experiences I had early when I was teaching at the university level with cheating, where I was just like, guys, you're not in middle school. You're not in high school. Your parents aren't making you be here. This is about growth. This is about becoming a career professional. Like, why the fuck would you cheat? Like, you're only cheating yourself because right. now you're leaving a class that you paid for without the knowledge that you need in order to be successful in your career. It's the weirdest thing, this sort of intense need to self-deceive or this intense need to prove something to other people when ultimately you're really only fucking yourself over.
Right. And, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of my daughter's going to college or to university mm-hmm. very soon. And this is not cheap. I mean, this is a crazy amount of money. And I'll try not to rant about, you know, how much, how much higher education costs have gone up in the past 20 years. It is insane. But if she did fantastic in high school, straight A's, so proud of her, amazing girl in so many ways. But if I catch a hint of her in college wasting the money that is being sent, that only hurting herself and the people that are paying for it, I will just say, I will just like pull her out because you've got to take this seriously. Have your fun. You're of course you're alone. You're at in college. Have fun, but take your work seriously. And if you're not going to be taking it seriously, then I'm not going to help you do it because that is just you are just cheating yourself. It's a horrible thing to waste.
Yeah, like what is the point of being there if you're just going to fuck off and not take the work seriously? Well, you might as well just go to community college and pay for it yourself. And then you'll actually feel the burden because, of course, university is like 10 times that price. And now mom and dad are feeling the burden.
Yeah. But I really, I mean, when I think about it, though, I'm not worried at all. She's just so motivated to do well and do her homework. I mean, I would call her in high school and like, hey, let's go to the movies. And she's like, oh, I'd love to, but I've got to do my homework. I mean, I wasn't even that good. Aww. When I was in high school.
Yeah.
I'd be like, yeah, let's go to the movies. So I'm just, I don't know where she got her motivation from. She didn't really get it from me, but I'm just, yeah, she's just amazing. So I'm sure she's going to do very well, whatever she decides.
So one thing that some of my listeners might not realize, and I didn't even realize until I interviewed Steve, I mean, you're talking about having a daughter who's about to go to college, is that you are the oldest of the SGU Novella brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
You're big brother Bob.
Yeah, I'm 13 months older than Steve, so of course, which amazes the crap out of people. And I mean, it makes sense because I mean, for whatever genetic anomaly, Steve started going gray in his late 20s, actually, and was fully gray, I think, well into his 30s or early 40s. So he's got that, which of course, you know, gray hair or white hair will definitely, age you, people will think that you're older. And it actually, it's funny because it helped Steve because he's a doctor and people don't want to be treated by these young whippersnappers. So if they think you're actually 10 or 15 years older than you are, then, you know, when you're in your early or mid 30s, that's actually a bonus. So that's a plus. So I mean, it's just funny. If Steve wants to look like 10 or 15 years younger, all he's got to do is dye his hair, which is an easy fix that some people would actually kill to have. So, and he,
that's
but he doesn't
true,
care. He doesn't care at all. Which is great.
Yeah, there are definitely other ways people look older. And it's true. Like, I think it's twofold. He looks a little older because he has, you know, a full head of white distinguished hair. But I think that you also look much younger because you are very, very fit. It's pretty obvious that you take physical fitness really, really seriously. Do you work out, like, constantly, or is that just genetics?
I've been working out since I was lifting weights, basically, since I was 14. My uncle Bob, who I was named after, who was big in, was big into weights and lifting weights, and he had his years in his youth where he was, you know, quite fit and quite big. So he got me into lifting weights when I was 14. So I've been lifting, you know, fairly regularly since then. So we're talking many decades of lifting. So I'm not a bodybuilder, huge type guy, but I've always been fit, and I've taken fitness very seriously for my entire life, more so than anybody else in my family. So I've definitely considered that a priority my entire life, thanks to Uncle Bob, I guess. Thank you, Uncle Bob.
What about your diet? Are you, like, really focused on making sure that you're eating well all the time?
I had my phase where fat was the enemy in terms of really? Dietary intake, and if you can believe it, I know you're not going to believe this, but I probably had a period of years where I did not even eat peanut butter. Just let that soak in for a little while. I would not even eat peanut butter, which I can't even imagine these days. I was so obsessed with fat. I would put, you know, skim milk in my coffee because you know, regular milk is just full of fat and all this stuff. So I was obsessed with minimizing fat. And I still think it's a valuable technique because when you're minimizing fat intake, you're minimizing calorie intake, which is pretty much what it's all about. Calories in, calories out, ultimately. So yeah, so I had my phase where I was a little bit obsessed. But yeah, I definitely think about what I eat in terms of I don't go overboard with the calories because I was never a big cardio type of person. Trying to do more cardio now, but I could never stick with it. For some reason, I just don't enjoy cardio that much. So I've always been more of a weightlifting guy. But I'm not obsessive. But I never eat butter. I mean, that's one of the holdovers from my low fat craze was butter. I mean, butter is awesome. I mean, who doesn't love butter? But I obsessively avoided it for so long that I don't even touch it any ever. You know, if it's on something, fine, but I could always taste it if it's there, and I try to avoid it. But I wouldn't say I'm obsessive at all. I just take it easy. I mean, for example, every day at work I'll have my egg sandwich. I've got an egg sandwich, and at lunch I almost invariably eat a Clif Bar with peanut butter and coffee. That's why I just love Clif Bars and peanut butter. Not a lot of peanut butter, but I put a nice layer on top. And then dinner is whatever dinner is. I don't go crazy. I mean, once in a while, I'll have an ice cream dinner. I will forego dinner and I will have ice cream for dinner. And that doesn't happen very often. But I think it's a great way to minimize the guilt because, you know, in terms of calories, it's probably close to being equal, you know. So it's not like I'm adding 600 calories on any given day. And you're full after you eat the ice cream. And, of course, it's ice cream. So it's wonderfully delicious. And if there's a dessert, I've got a standing rule. If I'm at a restaurant and they actually have a peanut butter-based dessert, I almost have to order that. That doesn't happen very often, unfortunately. But I don't go crazy with desserts. I mean, if there's like an ice cream cake for a birthday party, I will have a piece. You know, I won't go crazy with it and have, you know, three helpings. But I'll have some. I don't try to deprive myself, but I'm not obsessive about it. One way my diet could probably be a lot better is in terms of the fruits and vegetables. That's probably something where I'm quite lax, but otherwise, in terms of just going crazy with fried foods and also bacon or whatever, in moderation.
Yeah, I mean, bacon causes cancer. You heard the news, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. That's something that I'm trying to learn because I'm at that transitional age now. I'll be 33 in a few months, and
you
I
baby.
Was always a skinny kid. I know, I'm a baby. I was always a really skinny kid. I weighed, you know, less than 100 pounds most of my life. And then as I approached my late 20s, a lot of things changed. Obviously, like, you have these metabolic changes. I also quit smoking. I also started taking antidepressants. I also, you know, probably slowed down a little bit in terms of just how much energy I had. And I started to gain weight. And I... I struggle the way that I think a lot of kids who had my sort of genetic predisposition to being really skinny struggle, in that I never establish good habits.
Yes.
And so I'm having to learn as an adult, like, how to eat things that are green and how to say no to a second serving of ice cream. And it's really tough. Like, there's a big part of me that kind of just wishes I was a fat kid, because I feel like I would have learned restraint when I was young, you know? It's we all have our own struggles.
It's probably good that you weren't an overweight kid. I mean, some of the when I was really reading this stuff, some of the things that I've read is that there's some critical points in your life where you don't want to be overweight. I think it's early in life, and then around puberty, and then maybe there's some other point in time, because those are the very few periods in your life where the actual number of fat cells in your body are determined, and you want obviously the minimum amount of fat cells, because the more fat cells you have, then the very much harder it's going to be to lose that weight, because you just have so many of these cells. And even if you gain a little bit, you know, if all the fat cells get only a little bit bigger, that still can translate into a lot of excess weight, because you've got so many of these cells. So that might be a good thing, but it's never too late to get these good dietary habits. And like you said, you noticed it around 30 or so, late 20s. That's the key time, because that's the point in your life where your metabolism says, all right, I'm going to start taking it easy. And at most people, when after they hit 30, they'll generally gain a pound of fat a year and lose a pound of muscle a year. Now, this is information that I've read a few years ago. I'm not sure if it's still up to date, but it kind of makes sense, and you could actually see it. And there's lots of anecdotes supporting it. That so over time, by the time you're 40, you could actually weigh the same, but you will have about 10 pounds less muscle and 10 pounds more fat. So you are much less fit and toned.
Yeah, and you'll look different too.
And you will look fit. True. Clothes will fit different. You will look different in your bathing suit. So it's a struggle. People, if you realize that and you stay fit, you can't remove this nasty progression that everyone goes through, but you could slow it down significantly. And even, you know, most anyone can get in fantastic shape if they just, you know, make these changes in their lifestyle. And I think that's the key. I would never go on a diet, because diets are temporary. You change your diet for a little while, you lose the weight, you're happy, and then you go back to your old habits, and then you just get right back where you were, and actually you'll get back to a worse position than you were in. So I think if you want to seriously get fit and lose weight, you have to make permanent changes to your diet and stick with it for the rest of your life. Reasonable, not, you know, don't deprive yourself, because that's when you slip up. You deprive yourself of some of the things you love, like peanut butter. You deprive yourself, and then you
love peanut butter.
You have your nights. Oh my God, obsessed. You deprive yourself, and then you have a night where you just say, fuck it, and you just go crazy, and then you feel like crap the next day. Just, you know, have a little of what you enjoy. Just don't go crazy. Just like I said, moderation is key.
Yeah, it's so true. And did I tell you that I don't?
Oh, well, one thing I wanted to add is that if you could just make one change in your life, it would. Two things you could do: eat a little less and move more. Fitness and exercising, even just gardening. You don't have to do marathons. Just be more active. Or even if you just you buy one of those desktop things that they have now, where you stand up. You occasionally will stand up instead of sitting down all day. Just the act of standing is so much better for you. And we're actually finding now that sitting down for 8 hours at a stretch is horrible for you. Even some of the studies I've read recently actually shocked me. They said that even if you are a fit person who exercises, lifts weights, and does cardio, if you sit down for 8 hours a day in front of a computer, that is, it's like you're a smoker almost. It's almost like you are just a sedentary person, because that is so horrible. So get up, move around every couple hours, try to do the standing desk thing, which I'm seriously considering. Do that stuff. I try to walk at work. We've got a nice big parking garage right near where I am, and I'll go for a half hour walk twice a day, and just don't sit down for 8 hours. That's horrible for you.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. And take the stairs instead of the elevator if you can. That's like always an easy way to just force yourself to be a little more active.
Don't park far away. You don't have to park right next to the
building.
Park at the farthest parking spot that you have. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, that's what I love about Pokemon Go. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking about Pokemon Go. It's a goofy game. I can't believe I'm playing it. And I was never into Pokemon. But one of the things that I absolutely love about it is it makes you have to walk to do this. You cannot play. You basically cannot play unless you are walking. And it's, so that, to me, that's just like this fantastic idea that they're kind of forcing people to actually, you know, socialize with friends, but also walk to enjoy the game. I think it's a wonderful idea.
Wait, you're actually playing Pokemon Go?
You might want to edit that out of the game. I am. So many people. My girlfriend Liz is playing, and my niece, and I had to see what the fuss was about, because this has exploded. I don't think there's been any app that has exploded like this one has. This is just, everyone's talking about it. So I'm like, what the hell is this? I was never into Pokemon. What is it? So it's just a goofy game. It's kind of fun. I'm not even sure how long I'm going to do it, but I'm kind of enjoying it a little bit right now, and I'm not even a big game player either, but it's just you kind of get swept up into it, and I'm enjoying it for the walking aspect. We went for a walk for like an hour and a half yesterday playing this stupid game, but we burned a lot of calories, so hey, what the hell.
Looks like the servers are down in the UK right now and people are losing
their minds. Believe me, I've noticed. But people are claiming that it was a denial of service, a hacker attack, but other people are saying no, it's not. It's not the hacker. So it's interesting to see how that plays out. Is it really hackers, or is it just the incredible popularity that's bringing these servers down? Or another angle I read was that it's not really because there's too many people, it's because there was something wrong with the servers. Authenticating the servers was a problem, something I could relate to in my line of business, but all I got to say is they better fix those damn servers fast.
So, two things. One, did I tell you I don't like peanut butter?
I think you did, and I just kind of expunged it from my memory. So I,
yeah.
I don't
get peanut butter. I don't understand people's love for peanut butter. It's not my favorite.
I remember somebody said that peanut butter is primarily an American thing. And not only that, it's primarily like a white guy American thing. So I don't know what to make of that, but I'm a white American, so maybe. To me, it's the synergy of peanut butter and chocolate is magic. It's like quantum mechanics. It's magic. My favorite thing, I think, is peanut butter and chocolate-based whatevers. And so, yeah, that's fine. I mean, the way my typical response to that is, that's fine, more peanut butter for me. I'm okay with it.
Yeah, see, that's how I feel about chocolate and caramel, or as you probably say, caramel. Yeah. I'm definitely not a peanut butter eater. But two, I would highly recommend, when you said that you weren't really that into cardio, I would highly recommend running with the Zombies Run app. If you've never played with the Zombies Run app, it's so much fun.
I've heard of it. But do you actually have to run? Can you walk fast?
You can walk fast. Actually, you can walk fast, and you don't do it on a treadmill. That's the thing that gets me. Like, I hate running in a gym. Go outside. You guys live in the most beautiful place in Connecticut. Like, go outside, go on a run through the woods on a main drag, and then when the zombies start chasing you, you run a little bit faster. So you could actually walk and then only run when the zombies are chasing you.
Now tell me, what do you mean zombies chase you? Do you have your phone like Pokemon Go type of thing, or how do you know they're chasing you?
It's not augmented reality. It's all audio. So imagine that it's like a podcast that works with whatever music player you use. So you put it in your pocket, and there's a whole thing where like you crash land and you're near the base, and the base people are trying to tell you what to do, and you go on these runs to get more supplies, and you hear the zombies as they start chasing you, and they're like, and then they're like, run for your life, and you have to run from the zombies, and then it tells you when you've outrun them, and then you're back in with your like mission control person. Who's like taking you through the story. Yeah, and periodically, it's like you're listening to an old radio station,
gotcha.
And periodically it'll just play your music.
That's funny, because my knee-jerk reaction would never be to run away from zombies, but to get right in their face and check them out and see how cool they are. So I'd have to actually change my hard wiring to actually deal with that.
You would. Oh, yeah. Didn't you and I do a zombie throwdown when we were at the Skeptical Extravaganza?
I don't want to talk about it. Yes, you beat me.
That was so much fun, by the way.
And that was. Those throwdowns are my favorite parts about the extravaganza, because they're completely off the cuff. And even though I, you know, part of me would like to, you know, to at least have the list of topics known beforehand so we could do a little bit of prep, because I still get nervous going on stage, and to me one of my nightmares is to be completely unprepared on I literally have nightmares about going on stage and being unprepared. So I prepare, you and you probably know, I prepare incessantly until I've got my talk completely down. I've had a brain fart on stage, like I think really just once, where I talking about quantum mechanics and I completely lost my train of thought. And to me, that is a complete and utter nightmare. So the idea of this throwdown is scary as hell to me, because I'm afraid they would bring up a topic that I just cannot debate well, because I'm forgetting some key information that would be obvious, and everyone in this on stage would be like, Bob, why don't you just mention this? And that's scary. But I have to say, my experience with the throwdowns has been wonderful. I've won a lot. I've beaten Steve, which I think is fantastic. And I've actually been funny. I've actually been very, very, very funny with some of these throwdowns, with some of my comments that everyone was kind of cracking up. And that, of course, is like heroin on stage. When you actually are funny and cracking everyone up, to me, that is just like nirvana, because that's just such a wonderful experience to just be off the cuff hilarious. That, and it doesn't happen often. And I've experienced it with these throwdowns. So I just love it. And so I'll have a throwdown any day. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I was pretty nervous. It's funny because I don't really get stage fright. I think that you and I have a very different approach to how we prepare for talks or how we prepare for panels. Like, I'm often not underprepared, but I'm just prepared enough because I like to be a little off the cuff and I like to not have too many notes. And of course, I think because of a little bit of stage fright, it's really important for you that you know exactly what you have all of your notes and you know exactly what you want to say. But that said, I am not an expert by any stretch. I don't even have like minimal knowledge about basic sci-fi kind of nerd things. Like, there's so many things that the SGU just knows backwards and forwards. And if they were ever like, you need to argue like Next Generation versus the original Star Trek, I'd be like, I have no idea where to even start. Oh, yeah. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, and
it'd be so hard.
Right, it would. And but still, I think, I mean, you're loquacious. I mean, you can talk. You don't need to.
Oh, I can bullshit.
But that's
it. Really what it comes down to.
See, that's critical. I cannot. And I can give you a great example with Steve. I took an English class with Steve, and I actually read the book. I read the book, and we're driving to school. We had a half-hour drive to school, and Steve, for whatever reason, didn't read the book, which Steve would rarely do. He was always very prepared. So he didn't read the book, so I basically described the book to him. And then I remember a day or two later, after the test, he came to me, and he said, oh, I know what the scores were on our English test, on that book test, and he did better than I did on the test. And I remember,
because you told him everything.
I told him he did better than I did. He didn't even read the fucking book. And and when he told me the scores, I punched him in the stomach. I distinctly remember punching him in the stomach. I was so pissed. And so that's a quality that Steve has that you have. If you just have a little bit of information, you could talk about it. You could bullshit about it. You could be compelling and interesting. For me, if I don't have information to talk about, I just don't have much to say about it. So that's one of the reasons why I have to prepare obsessively, because I need to have something to talk about. I need to have it on the tip of my tongue. And also there's that aspect of being nervous on stage that just exacerbates the whole thing. So that's why I have to do that.
It makes me wonder, though, if that sort of self-reflection that you have right now is a true reflection of reality, or if it's, again, one of those kind of cognitive biases where you actually just think you're not a good bullshitter, so you don't really try to bullshit. I wouldn't be surprised. I think you could probably bullshit. I mean, you're shooting the shit with me for this hour, and you are like really loquacious. Like, I feel like I'm hearing you talk more than I ever hear you talk, which
maybe
is really exciting for
maybe
me.
Maybe a combination of the two.
Yeah, I think probably. I think so. Because you always have so much interesting stuff to say.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Hard to say. If I don't know anything about something, I mean, unless I could find some hook or some link that I could talk about. Like, for example, I took a Dale Carnegie course many years ago, which was basically public speaking, which is as you know, the number one fear, even you know, more than death itself. People are afraid of public speaking, and of course, as am I. So I took the class, and I did well. You basically had to prepare these 1 or 2 minute talks every week and talk in front of the class of 30 people or so. And there was one class that I was dreading. This was the impromptu class. This is the class where you had to go up on stage in front of everyone and talk about a topic that you were given when you go on stage. So I'm freaking out because there's no prep. I have nothing to prep. What if I just – it was something I couldn't talk about. So I was handed a piece of paper. I got on stage kind of sweating, and it said highway. It just said highway. What the hell are you going to talk about a highway? But I remembered a funny story of me and Jay on the highway, on the road, going in Florida, traveling to Disney World. And this was when Jay had long, long curly hair. And so we're driving, and we get stopped by a cop. And you know, it's a Southern cop, and you hear stories about Southern cops. I've never had a bad experience with them, but I'm like, oh, Jay, he's going to see you with this long hair, and I think he even had an earring, and he's going to haul us in because he's going to think you're a weirdo, and who knows what else he's going to think. So I'm like, Jay, turn your head to the right, pretend like you're sleeping, and maybe he'll think you're a girl, and we'll be okay. So it's just a funny, goofy story, and I said that. I got a laugh out of everybody, and I actually won the award for best impromptu speech that I was so proud of. I still have the pen that said Dale Carnegie, best impromptu speech, and I was just so proud of that. So it's just a funny story that actually probably helped me increase my confidence for at least a couple weeks.
That's amazing. That makes me so happy. I love hearing about these early novella stories too. I think that is really in some ways a big part of the charm of the podcast, because there's no denying the chemistry that you have on the show. It's interesting because you have another brother. What's his name?
It's Joe. It's Joe. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've met Joe.
Yeah, Joe is my twin. Joe is my twin, fraternal twin. He's 4 minutes older. And
That's insane. Joe is your twin. You guys look nothing alike. I mean, you look alike because all novellas look alike,
but
you look nothing alike.
It's ironic
but you're fraternal, that's why.
Right. We're just like regular brothers. Actually, and it's just a coincidence that I happen to look more like Jay and Steve than I do my own fraternal twin. Which is kind of funny.
Hilarious.
But yeah, Joe's a great guy. We've had him on the show, and he always listens to the show, and a super bright guy. He's just so knowledgeable about now his new career. The past 5 or 6 years has been energy conservation, and heating and air conditioning, like buildings and how much money and energy is wasted, and he could talk about solar energy all day, nonstop. He's just so knowledgeable about it. It's amazing. And he's doing so well. I'm so proud of him.
That's awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, I've met Joe a few times, and Joe is a skeptic, right? Joe is like, I mean, when we have conversations, we're like on the same page with a lot of things.
Yeah.
I think he's also politically aligned with me in a lot of ways. Why is it that Joe did not come together with you guys when you first started forming Nexus and the Skeptics Guide? Or not Nexus, but Ness.
Think about that. Yeah, just the whole skeptical thing. You know, he was kind of... Yeah. Steve, Jay, and I were a little bit closer. Joe was so busy. He was working with my dad as a general contractor, doing very well in that business. He was separated from us for a bit. He was just so busy with that stuff, and we were kind of just, maybe a little bit more into the whole thing. You know, it wasn't necessarily the kind of thing he would want to dedicate so much time to, I guess. I mean, actually, I'm trying to think of why that happened. And perhaps I think the atheist angle might have been a little bit off-putting to Joe. He was Catholic back then, and he believed.
Gotcha.
Although that has changed, he is definitely on the side of atheism / agnosticism these days, for sure. So he definitely, you know, came around to, you know, more of our way of thinking, at least when it comes to atheism and agnosticism. So that may have played a bit of a part in it as well, perhaps. But yeah, so he's totally on board, total skeptic and you know, into science and all that stuff. So that's for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. And Steve, I think, does a good job. Obviously, Steve is like kind of the Mac Daddy of the show. And like,
sure,
he does a good job policing us a little bit to try and keep the atheism talk to a minimum, and also to try and keep the political talk to a minimum, because for him, I think he wants to keep the skepticism really pure. When
Absolutely.
It's relevant to skepticism, we bring it in.
Right.
But for me, it's very hard for me to hide my atheism. I mean, I don't try to hide it. I'm an atheist activist too, but like, I am so obviously an atheist, and I'm so obviously progressive and left-leaning,
yep,
that it's just a part of who I am. And so I have to be mindful on the show of making sure that if I do make a comment that's politically or religiously charged, that it has evidence to back it up, because that's what the show is about.
Absolutely. We're doing science outreach here, and this is our niche, talking about anything that deals with science, whether it's, you know, critical thinking, or whether it's even politics or religion. If you say the earth is 6,000 years old, and it's part of your religion, we will absolutely address that. And the same with politics, but we try not to do any, you know, religion bashing or Republican/Democrat bashing, straight bashing, because that's not what we're about. We're about the science. And also, I find it makes a lot of sense, because when you start bashing, you know, religion and politics, these are such emotional issues for people that the shields come right up, and a lot of, you know, it's hard to get through to that. We find, for us, it's been very successful if you give the people, you know, the tools of skepticism, of critical thinking and spotting logical fallacies. If you give them those tools, then eventually they can start applying those tools to religion and politics. And that, I think that's a very, very effective way to get people to be skeptical and science-minded about religion and politics. And I think it's a wonderful approach. And that's what works for us. That's what we enjoy. That's what we want to do. If you want to be the type of skeptics that is all about talking about either religion or politics, then that's your niche, and that's fine. Have at it. And I love this diversity of approach, and why I disagree so much with people that say, no, this is how you are a proper skeptic. You should talk about this. Basically, talk about the things that I'm interested in skepticism, and not the things that you're interested in. And I just totally disagree with that. I love the idea that people are approaching it from their passions. Because if you're passionate about a specific area of skepticism and science, then that's what you're going to be passionate about. That's what you're going to stick with. You're not going to do it for a month and be like, I'm done with this crap. You know, so I think it's wonderful. How boring would it be if all skeptics just focused on, and like, say, alt med, you know, or quantum woo or homeopathy? That would be horrible.
Just like Bigfoot all the time.
Right. And people bash Bigfoot. And Steve has said on the show many times that Bigfoot, it's not a waste of time to talk about Bigfoot. Just, you know, it's kind of interesting and weird and goofy, but if you look you could look at Bigfoot as a microcosm of all of skepticism, because it teaches you how, you know, the mechanisms of self-deception, you know, evaluating evidence, it's all there in this little tiny world of just little old stupid hairy Bigfoot. And you could, if you could dissect skeptically Bigfoot from A to Z, and you could then actually apply that to so many other areas. So it's not a waste of time to talk about Bigfoot. Just don't obsess over it.
Yeah. Do you know that I've had, because I work in television, it's not uncommon. It doesn't happen all the time, but it's not uncommon for me to get a call from a production company or from a network saying, you know, we're working on this show and we're thinking about casting, and it's really important to us to have like the token skeptic. Like, we really want, or they won't word it that way, but they'll be like, that's what I know they want, where they'll be like, it's a show about investigating Bigfoot, and then we're going to have like these primatologists, and we're going to have these, you know, Bigfoot hunters, but we really want somebody on the panel who's like, you know, really skeptical and who wants to kind of debunk Bigfoot. And I always say, like, no, I'm not going to play that role. I think it's, again, because we're not monolithic and because you're right, we have to approach these things from so many different angles. It's a good role for someone out there to play. Honestly, I think that you or Jay or Steve or even Evan would be really good in that role. But for me, I would hate to be put on a show as the token skeptic who basically becomes the villain. You know, that's how they always couch you.
Right.
Is like when they're in post, when they're in edit, it's like, oh, she's the angry science lady who just doesn't want to have any fun. And you're like, oh, Jesus. It's so frustrating, yeah. But that's really how we oftentimes present skepticism in science and television. And so for me, it's about kind of changing that approach so that people understand, you know, to be a scientific thinker and to be a skeptical thinker, you get to have fun too. And you're not just always there to like break people's dreams. You're there to help people see what it is, which is so much more beautiful.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard at times to be a skeptic. You're basically, you're not offering hope in a lot of cases. It's like the stark reality of the way things are, and that could be a bummer, and that's too bad. But also, I think it should be flip-flopped. I think there should be a token believer because these are the people that are on the fringes. These are the people that are not with the scientific consensus. So if you want to actually have a token somebody, it should be the other way around. But that's not appealing, to everybody, because people love the paranormal and all this stuff. So they don't want to have a little token believer. They want just a little token, buzzkill person.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, Bob, we have been chatting for quite some time. I've been having such a good time. Before I move on, I always have a closing segment where I ask all of my guests the same two questions. Ooh, I'm going to put Bob on the spot. But before we do, I'm wondering if there's anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten to. Is there anything you can think of before we move on to that last segment?
Maybe real quickly, it's actually related to Pokemon Go. I was just having a conversation today about this. I was saying is that, Pokemon Go is fun and goofy and stuff, but I think this silly little app is actually something that we're going to see so much more in the future. And specifically, I'm talking about virtual reality and augmented reality. I think going to be such a huge thing. I mean, this is such a minor representation of that. But imagine in the future when VR, for years I've thought my ultimate piece of tech is going to be a pair of very cool looking sunglasses that is my entire interface into the digital world. It will be, it will be your TV, your computer monitor, your reminders. Someone, your friend comes up to you and you haven't seen him in 5 years, and your VR will just overlay these texts, texts saying, oh, this is Steve, and his birthday is tomorrow. Wish him a happy birthday. Just stupid stuff. Or you're working on your car, or you're operating on somebody, and you can overlay the CT scan or the X-rays or the car engine and to help you work on whatever you're working on. There's just so many ways that this is going to be integrated into our society, and you can't predict what's going to be popular. Just like, 15 years ago, who would have thought that texting would be something that would essentially supplant phone conversations? I don't think too many people predicted it.
It seems so much harder. Right. Yeah, it's like, why would you text when you can just call?
I remember saying when I first started texting, like, why not just call a person? And of course, now I understand texting in the vast majority of cases is so much better than phone calling. But so like that, for VR and augmented reality, it's hard to say what the four or five killer apps are going to be that people are going to obsess over. But my point is that that the technology is so broad that there's going to be some aspects of it that are going to sweep the world. It's just there's just too much utility there, and it's a technology that I think people are going to be obsessing over. Some of these games that are going to be coming out, once the technology, of course, is cheaper and much more portable and much more powerful, I think it's going to be the killer bit of tech for a generation. It's going to be I just can't wait to experience what this technology is going to be like, and we're just seeing little hints of it now with this Pokemon Go and of course Oculus and all these other bits of tech that are coming out for VR that people are starting to obsess over. We're just at the very beginning of this ride, and it's going to be a hell of a ride.
Yeah, I agree. We're not going to have cell phones anymore. We're not going to have all these different pieces of equipment. You're right. It's all just going to be in our glasses. And
right.
Everything is going to be on one dashboard. And because we're already seeing that, like people like myself who are big Mac users, everything's already really integrated. Like I have my phone, I have my iPod, I have my laptop, and they all talk to each other and they all talk to each other through the cloud. And all of the same programs are used. And I can check my texts on my laptop and I can listen to my music on my phone. And eventually, you're just not going to need that anymore. It's going to be one piece of tech, or you're going to have different iterations that just make it easier, like we do with these Apple products.
Like I'm sitting,
it's true. I've got you on that.
I've got two monitors in front of me right now. I've got behind me, I've got a 60-inch, you know, HD TV. At work, I've got three monitors in front of me. You know, I think we could eventually see these actually go away. I mean, you're basically cutting out the middleman. You're getting rid of the hardware because all the hardware you'll need will be in front of your eyes, either beaming it onto your retina or projecting it onto the glasses themselves. You could have a little screen in front of you, or that screen could expand to fill all of your peripheral vision, total VR immersion, telepresence. You know, you could do whatever you want. It could be just a little bit of text in the upper corner telling you, you know, how fast you're going, who, what friends might be near, or how about a quick little thumbs up review on a restaurant you're just walking by, or it could be just a full on, you know, virtual reality immersion, playing a game in another world. I mean, there's just so much that's possible there, and it's going to be, I predict it will be a killer app. That we're going to see. Who knows? Once it'll be small enough to be just like sunglasses, but whatever, it's going to happen. 10 years, who knows? I'm done.
And the cool thing about that is then we can live in a world where like you could actually just take it off and really be back to a more natural setting instead of this world that's like, you know, we always see in movies like the future worlds like Minority Report and everything just looks like Times Square. But if we can integrate it all into our own personal devices, then actually you can take a little vacation just by taking your glasses off of your face. And I love the idea because for me, that's what it's about right now. I've been camping a lot lately and it's about this juxtaposition between being fully connected and really enjoying my life. I live in a home now that's kind of an updated home that's got a lot of cool connected tech in it.
Yeah.
But then driving out to Joshua Tree or driving up to Yosemite and like literally putting my phone in the glove box and not even taking pictures, you know, like I just don't even have my phone with me and it's amazing. Like I love it.
But it's funny you say take a vacation. You could take a vacation from your digital life, but you could also take a vacation from your real world. And I could be sitting on my bed, put on the glasses, and I could be like in the woods or I could be in Australia.
That's true.
I mean, you can take a vacation, you know, away or towards or whatever you want. So and so quickly and easily in 4K resolution. Or maybe 8K.
Yes.
8K.
Or 8K, yeah. And fully immersive with like Dolby Digital Surround.
My God.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
All right.
So anyway, all right. Moving on to my last two questions.
Sure.
And I ask everybody these, so I'm always really excited to see what people's takes are on them. Twofold. First one being, when you look to the future in whatever context that is, you know, relevant to you today, it could be really, really personal, or it could be like big picture global stuff. Number one, what is the thing that worries you the most about the future? What are you the most concerned about? What keeps you up the most at night? And then on the flip side of that, just so we don't end on such a bummer, what are you most excited and optimistic for?
Okay. What am I concerned about? I guess apocalypse. Apocalypse is scary. I mean, zombies are awesome and all, but there's just so many ways for the shit to hit the fan, whether it's a global pandemic, whether it's a nuclear exchange. Oh my God. You know, some of these countries just scare the crap out of me in terms of, you know, some countries that are actually, you know, looking to create the apocalypse because that's what they think prophecy is has in store for everybody. So that's scary because so worldwide destruction is not something, you know, or mutually assured destruction is not something they're afraid of. So that's really scary. You know, any type of extremism, whether it's religious or political extremism, scares me a lot, but some sort of preventable apocalypse, whether it's an asteroid strike or some civilization ending scenario, whether, you know, global pandemic, nuclear nukes, whatever, those are scary. Those are things that, you know, just to think that, you know, all the young people around today just not being able to enjoy life, like especially my daughter. It's, you know, it's hard not to think about, you know, my daughter in this case, you know, having her, you know, being forced to live in a collapsed civilization because people are just fucking crazy nuts, that is that's a scary scenario. And you know, to think that we could lose everything that we've built, especially when I'm convinced that we are on the precipice of some amazing stuff, which kind of segues into your part two of what I'm most looking forward to. I'm most looking forward to what I think we are on the precipice of in terms of, you know, long, like, health spans that last for 2, 3, 4, 5 times. Imagine being healthy for 500 years. I think that is achievable. Also, the technology, some of we've been talking about with virtual reality and augmented reality, I'm so hopeful and looking forward to some of the things we can achieve with science and technology, whether it's nanotechnology or artificial intelligence, robotics. Those things, I think these are things that are going to change society in such a fundamental way. It's, you know, it's not going to be incremental improvements. We are going to reach a point where we could actually, you know, feed and clothe the entire world, get rid of pollution, solve problems. I mean, with AI, if we can create a benign artificial superintelligence, the things that it would be able to solve are just so amazing. I am convinced this is achievable within a relatively brief time span. It's, of course, it's hard to predict. I can't give you a date, but whether it's 20 years or 80 or 100 years, I think we are on the verge of amazing things that we can all achieve if we just realize that it's coming and work to achieve it. I think we could absolutely get there, and I'm just so excited. That's why one of the reasons why I love science fiction so much, to see some of these ideas come to life on a screen, some of the things that we can potentially achieve, and some of these things that I know are so tantalizingly close that, you know, if I can't experience it, then my daughter will see it, or my grandkids are going to see such amazing things. And that's some of the things that sucks about dying, is that all the great stuff that I'm going to miss. I'm always fascinated. What are the limits of technology? What can we accomplish with technology? Especially now you were talking about quantum computers and areas of technology that we haven't even realized or explored yet. To me, is endlessly fascinating, and I love speculating about, you know, what we can potentially see, if not us, then our kids or grandkids. So that's what I love thinking about.
My gosh, well, now that I'm officially inspired, I am really excited to take on the rest of my weekend.
All
so,
right.
Bob, thank you so much for joining me. Before we go, why don't you let everybody know, you know, where you kind of exist on social media, where they can see some of the cool stuff that you do, especially if they're, I don't know how they wouldn't be, but if they're not familiar with SGU or they're not familiar with some of the things that you've written in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big Facebook fan. I just love Facebook. So just give me a search on Facebook. I'll be glad to be anyone's friend. So I'm very accessible there. Or I write a blog for theskepticsguide.org. I kind of took a little bit of a hiatus, but I'm getting back into it now. So you can see some of my blogs. You can go back and see all the blogs that I've written at theskepticsguide.org. Just go to the science news section. I'm right there. So those are my two primary outlets. You could also check out just in the Skeptics Guide on Facebook itself. Just a general Facebook page for our podcast. So those, I guess, would be the two or three primary outlets if you want to check out what I'm doing.
Awesome. Well, Bob, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I had so much fun, and I feel like I know you even better now.
Of course. Kara, this has been wonderful. I didn't have to prep for this, and I think it went so well. This was such a fast hour and 10 minutes and 35 seconds that I can't believe it. So you are an amazing, amazing interviewer, and I'm just so happy we finally got around to doing this.
Oh, stop! Or
no,
go
you,
on.
No, you
You're
come
so
on. No,
sweet.
No, I'll go on. You are. It's so easy to talk to you. I now know why that you're so popular and so many people love your show, is because you are just a natural at this stuff. So.
Well, thank you so much. And I have to kind of repeat the compliment, because I have to say, I have not been a part of the SGU for long, but I already feel like, you know, like one of your sisters, and it's been so much fun. How quickly I feel like we've all connected, and it's just so easy having conversations with you guys as well. So I'm just glad to round out the SGU by having everybody on the show. So.
And I'll go ahead. I'll spit that right back at you, because I remember when we first interviewed you at TAM, probably 3 or 4 years ago. After this has only happened once. This happened after we did our first interview of Rebecca. After we interviewed you, we all looked at each other and said, "Damn, we just mesh and have chemistry with her so well. It was so obvious that we had the chemistry, and we just all got along. We just knew it from that first interview, how we feel about you has just increased as we have you on our show. I think we are all wonderful together. And Jay has said you fit in so quickly and easily. You are absolutely one of us now, and that just is a testament to how, you know, just to how interesting and intelligent and funny you are. So and we just naturally mesh for whatever reason, and it's a wonderful. I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Aw, thank you, Bob. I'm going to wipe this big goofy smile off my face now and say thank you for joining me, and thanks everyone else for tuning in week after week. Yeah. I am really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.